Iran removes two surveillance cameras of the International Atomic Energy Agency, saying that their activity was beyond its commitments under the Safeguards Agreement. Iran's leader describes Hajj as a symbol of unity among Muslims and warns of UK attempts to create rift between Shias and Sunnis. And Russia says it is ready to help restart grain export from Ukraine if Kiev cooperates amid concerns about a global food crisis. Thanks for joining us. Iran says it has turned off a number of surveillance cameras of the International Atomic Energy Agency at one of its nuclear sites.
80% of surveillance cameras are operating under the safeguards of the IAEA. Iran remains committed to their operation and the devices will continue to work. Cameras installed beyond the safeguards obligations will be removed, and we have turned off a number of them. These cameras were put in place to record data to be provided to the IAEA. We won't provide the agency with such data anymore. We hope the nuclear watchdog changes its approach towards Iran. The IAEA cannot expect Iran to show extensive cooperation in response to the agency's non-cooperation.
The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran also says the IAEA has not only been ungrateful for Iran's extensive cooperation, but has also considered it as a duty. The remarks come in the wake of an anti-Tehran draft submitted to the IAEA by the U.S. and its three European allies. The draft accuses Iran of insufficient cooperation. Tehran has condemned the move. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the country has no hidden or undocumented nuclear activities or undisclosed sites. Mohammad Islami says submission of an anti-Tehran draft is in line with a political move to maintain maximum pressure on Iran. Meanwhile, Iran's acting ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency says that Tehran's remedial measures following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA are all in compliance with the NPT and the 2015 deal.
The root of the existing problem lies in the legal withdrawal of the U.S. from the JCPOA, and the Islamic Republic has taken remedial measures authorized by parliamentary legislation based on the NPT and Articles 23 and 26 of the JCPOA.
Mohammad Reza Ghaibi made the remarks on the sidelines of the quarterly meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors. Ghaibi said a recent report by the IAEA chief on Iran's nuclear program is unbalanced and has provided the U.S. and three European countries an excuse to submit a politically motivated resolution to the Board of Governors meeting. He said the resolution was unconstructive and damaging. Ghaibi said that Iran will respond firmly if the U.S. and Europeans keep pushing for ratification of the resolution. Leader of the Islamic Revolution has called for strengthening unity among Muslims, warning of Britain's attempts to sow discord among Shia and Sunni Muslims. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the remarks during a meeting with organizers of caravans of Iranian Hajj pilgrims. He said the pilgrimage is a manifestation of unity within the Muslim community. Ayatollah Khamenei also hit out at the nexus between some Arab governments and the Israeli regime, saying that normalization would be beneficial to no one. He said the ties with Israel would harm the very Arab countries that normalize. The leader said the people in those Arab countries are also opposed to shaking hands with the regime. Ayatollah Khamenei said normalization agreements come as a result of constant pressure that Washington puts on the involved governments. Four Arab countries, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, have already normalized with Israel under U.S. brokered agreements in 2020. The move sparked an outcry in the Muslim world. Palestinians in particular denounced it as a stab in the back. Earlier, the director of Risalat Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Mahdi Torabi, told us why Iran's leader blamed the United Kingdom for sowing discord among Muslims.
Well, you know, this is the old system that the British always use, which is divide and conquer. When they came to take over the Muslim world, they looked for different things that can separate the society, and with that division they can then rule. So one of the things that exists in the Muslim world is the difference between Shias and Sunnis. But the point that the Supreme Leader was making is that the things that Shias and Sunnis have in common are so much more than the differences, and the point is to focus on the commonalities and to focus on the common enemy, which is the British or the Americans after the British, who are trying to take over the whole Muslim world, and they don't care about Sunni Shia. So this is just a reminder of the historic role that the British have had in this story over the decades and almost more than a century.
Yemenis have slammed what they call the double standard of the international community regarding the conflicts in Yemen, Palestine, and Ukraine. Abdul Latif al-Bashali has more from Sana'a.
Under the title Collusion and Duplication in International Reports, Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a symposium to discuss the international positions in regards to the conflicts in Yemen, Palestine, and Ukraine.
We have clarified what is happening in the corridors of the UN in terms of double standards, resolutions, and briefings provided by UN envoy. As the laws enacted by the UN have not been implemented, military confrontation against the enemy is legitimate.
Officials say Western politicians have repeatedly shown their racism towards other nations, especially following the breakout of the Russia-Ukraine war.
There's a double standard confirmed by the abhorrent racism espoused by Western politicians who have said that people with black and brown skin are not able to compete with whites in all aspects of life. What is happening is an erosion of the international community, which stood by Ukraine in the face of Russia, while not moving a finger towards the suffering of Yemenis, Palestinians, and others around the world.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a deadly war on Yemen on March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children. Yemenis say the international community, including the United Nations, did not take any action to end the suffering of millions of Yemenis.
Experts say the Russia-Ukraine war has exposed double standards by the international community, criticizing it for taking a tough stance on Russia while turning a blind eye to Saudi and Israeli crimes against people in Yemen and Palestine. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
With a global food crisis looming, Russia says it is ready to help restart grain exports from Ukraine if Kiev cooperates.
To solve this problem, the only thing needed is for the Ukrainians to let vessels out of their ports, either by demining them or by making out safe corridors. Nothing more is required.
Lavrov was speaking after a meeting with the Turkish Prime Minister in Ankara. He said that Russia has already made the necessary commitments to ensure the safety of ships seeking to export grain from Ukraine. Russia and Turkey have agreed for Ukraine's grain to be shipped to Turkey and from there to the international market. Kyiv earlier said that it will not demine its waters, as it will lead to more attacks from Russia. Ukraine is one of the biggest grain exporters in the world. The United Nations previously asked the two countries to start grain exports from Ukraine in order to ease a looming food crisis across the world. When it comes to the Americas, just like other parts of the world, the region is going through serious economic challenges, such as inflation and poor growth. And President Biden of the U.S. has even made the matters worse. The White House has not invited Cuba and Venezuela to the 2022 Summit of the Americas in Los Angeles.
The United States has invited leaders of South and Central Americas to participate in the so-called the Summit of Americas. The summit, which runs from June the 6th to 10th in Los Angeles, is officially aimed at strengthening hemispheric solidarity. The conference comes amid growing U.S. involvement in the war in Ukraine and rising strategic rivalries between Beijing and Washington over hegemonic control of the global South. The summit is therefore an attempt to assert Washington's hegemonic ambitions over what it considers as its own backyard. However, it appears that countries in the region are not willing to bow down to U.S. ambitions. The U.S. regime has decided against inviting leaders of Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua to the regional summit of the Americas, risking an embarrassing boycott of the Washington-hosted gathering by regional leaders.
And again, is the idea that the OAS And the Summit of the Americas has been historically a place that advances the agenda of imperialist United States. And so tables are turning in the continent, which is really hopeful. People are beginning to see that there is a possibility to develop projects of nation states that are not under the boot of the United States of America.
Furthermore, leaders from Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador have rejected to participate in the Americas summit due to Washington's policy of exclusion after it refused to invite Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba to the gathering. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador slammed Washington's policy of exclusion and said it needs to change this desire to dominate the world without any reason. There cannot be an Americas summit if not all the continent's countries participate. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro praised the Mexican president's courage and clarity for choosing not to attend the summit, saying the U.S. government's decision to exclude three countries is an act of discrimination which ensures that the summit will fail. Chilean President Gabriel Boric also criticized the U.S. exclusion of South American countries and said that it was not the right path.
What is interesting in this context is that you have countries that are not necessarily socialist countries, but are countries that are starting to develop their own idea, their own vision of what their nation states should be, like is Mexico, going against a politic of extraction and going against a politic that continues to rob their dignity and their ability to be sovereign countries.
Biden's move to exclude certain states from the invitation list was not impressive to many Latin American countries. As parties like Mexico boycotted the event, others sent low-level delegates. That puts into question the real intention behind such decisions. Some observers believe the U.S. leadership is the matter of question.
U.S. hegemonic ambitions over South America dates back to early 19th century. It's related to Monroe Doctrine, which was formulated by James Monroe, the fifth U.S. president, in 1823. It officially declares that region the sphere of influence of the United States. And under Roosevelt, corollary to the doctrine named after President Theodore Roosevelt, the United States was justified in using police power to end chronic crises in the Western Hemisphere. The policy has paved the way for numerous U.S. interventions in the region. The occupation of Nicaragua and Haiti in the first two decades of the 20th century, the CIA operation in Guatemala in 1953, the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba in 1961, the coup against Chilean President Salvador Allende in 1973, and the invasion of Grenada in 1983 are just some of them. But the fact that U.S. hegemonic ambitions is being questioned by Latin American states is seen as the beginning of the falling influence of the United States in its own backyard.
The United States has lost a lot of its legitimacy around the world. And we need to see that, you know, there is the geostrategic battle that the United States has launched against China. And why is that important to the American continent? It is important because a lot of countries are beginning to develop relationships with China, understanding that there are other ways of developing economic and political plans that don't, again, necessarily have to subscribe to the U.S. imperialist forms.
With the rising influence of China and Russia in Latin America, the U.S. finds itself in a weaker position than before. Under the Trump administration, the U.S. did whatever it could do to topple Venezuela's government, but to no avail. And now, the new leftist turn amongst Latin American countries could be another blow to U.S. imperialist desires in that region.
The Iranian Petroleum Minister has warned Western states against punitive measures targeting Iran and Russia, saying that such behavior seriously threatens global energy security. Speaking at a ceremony marking Russia's National Day in Tehran, Javad Oji said that Iran and Russia are two major suppliers of oil and gas worldwide. He mentioned plans by the West to ban energy imports from Russia over the war in Ukraine. He said that Europe cannot easily find an alternative for Russian oil and gas, and that Washington's plans are detrimental to the interests of the international community. The Iranian minister said sanctions are no solution to any problem and will hurt the very countries that impose them. The UN has issued a stark warning of multiple looming food crises in war-torn countries. In a new report, the world body also said that Afghanistan is the new entry to the list of countries facing the highest alert and catastrophic conditions. Rahmatullah Bakhwan has more from Kabul.
In a new report aimed at highlighting hunger hotspots, the UN bodies warned that Afghanistan is the new entry to the list of countries at highest alert, facing catastrophic conditions. The report says, besides other causes, the ripple effects of the war in Ukraine, including rising prices, are adding to the difficulties of people to provide food.
Today, food prices are skyrocketing globally due to war in Ukraine and wheat and food exports crisis. Afghanistan, as an importing and dependent country, has received major impacts. Since we don't receive imported food or goods, we witness a quick rise in prices and food scarcity. Now the prices of food items are doubled and few people can afford them.
At the same time, Afghan middle-class families are sliding into poverty and hunger, as unemployment has been on the rise. Some also say that they are struggling to make ends meet.
Unemployment and poverty have severely increased. Not only me, but all of the people have slided into poverty. Joblessness has harmed us all. Last year I was a construction worker, but today I can't provide some loaves of bread for my family as I am unemployed. We are unable to make ends meet. The prices of food items have already soared.
Advocates in the country express concern about Afghanistan's worsening situation, saying the West, especially the U.S., share a major role in world poor people's suffering.
If we provide the percentage, the U.S. is 60-70% to blame for the ongoing crisis in Afghanistan, mainly due to their moves and mistakes. In addition, now the Ukraine war is affecting the Afghan economy, so who is prolonging the war in Ukraine? Again, the Western bloc, including the U.S. and the U.K. Prolonging the war might harm superpowers, but it definitely ruins the economy and lives of vulnerable people across the globe.
The UN Refugee Agency has also called for $3 billion in urgent aid to Afghanistan before winter to avert famine and death. Afghanistan is facing multiple humanitarian crises. Poverty and hunger, in particular, are taking their toll on millions of people in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
in the limelight.
For the last two decades, the United States has been conducting an undeclared war across much of the globe, employing proxy forces from Africa to Asia, deploying commandos from the Philippines to the West African nation of Burkina Faso, and conducting airstrikes not only in Libya but in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Over those years, the U.S. military has taken pains to normalize the use of drone warfare outside established war zones while relying on allies around the world to help conduct its global war. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Nick Turris, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Global Drone War Has Killed Untold Numbers of Civilians, Including Children. Madhuba's Musa Abdullah still remembers the phone call, but what came next was a blur. He drove for hours deep into the Libyan desert, speeding toward the border with Algeria. His mind buckled, his thoughts reeled, and more than 3 years later, he is still not certain how he made that six-hour journey. The call was about his younger brother, Nasser, who, as he told reporters, was more than a sibling to him. He was also a close friend. Nasser was polite and caring. He loved music, sang, and played the guitar. Abdullah finally found Nasser near the village of Al-Ayanat. Or rather, he found all that remained of him. Nasser and 10 others from their village of Obari had been riding in three SUVs that were now burnt-out hunks of metal. The 11 men had been incinerated. Abdullah knew one of those charred corpses was his brother, but he was at a loss to identify which one. If these bodies had recently been found strewn about in the village of Bucha or other places outside a train station in Kramatorsk or elsewhere, the images would have been splashed across the internet, earning worldwide attention and prompting fierce and justified outrage. Instead, the day after the attack, November 29, 2018, U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, issued a press release that was met with almost universal silence. Earlier this month, Abdullah, along with a spokesperson for his ethnic Tuareg community and representatives of three non-governmental organizations, the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, Italy's Red Italiana, PACE, DO, Disarmo, and Reprieve, a human rights advocacy group, filed a criminal complaint against Colonel Cirati, the former Italian commander at the U.S. Air Base in Sinola, Italy, from which that American drone took off. They were seeking accountability for his role in the killing of Nasser and those other 10 men. The complaint requested that the public prosecutor's office in Siracusa, where the base is located, prosecute Colonel Cirati and other Italian officials involved in that airstrike for the crime of murder. The drone attack of November 29, 2018, where 11 innocent people lost their lives in Libya, is part of the broader U.S. program of extrajudicial killings. This program is based on a notion of preemptive self-defense that does not meet the canons of international law, as the use of lethal attacks of this nature is only legitimate where the state is acting to defend itself against an imminent threat to life. In this circumstance, the victims posed no threats, reads the criminal complaint. In light of this premise, the drone attack on Al-Ayanat on November 29, 2018, stands in frontal contrast to the discipline, Italian and international, regarding the use of lethal force in the context of law enforcement operations. For the last two decades, the United States has been conducting an undeclared war across much of the globe, employing proxy forces from Africa to Asia, deploying commandos from the Philippines to the West African nation of Burkina Faso, and conducting airstrikes not only in Libya but in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Over those years, the U.S. military has taken pains to normalize the use of drone warfare outside established war zones while relying on allies around the world, as that Italian base in Syracuse, to help conduct its global war. "Clearly, a drone operation employing lethal force is not routine," said Meloni, legal advisor at European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, adding, "While AFRICOM is directly responsible, the Italian commander must have known about and approved the operation and can therefore be criminally responsible as an accomplice for having allowed the unlawful lethal attack." That November 2018, drone attack in Libya was anything but a one-off strike. During just 6 months in 2011 alone, U.S. MQ-1 Predator drones flying from Signola conducted 241 airstrikes in Libya during Operation Unified Protector, the NATO air campaign against then-Libyan autocrat Muammar Gaddafi, according to retired Lieutenant Colonel Gary Peppers, the former commander of the 324th Expeditionary Reconnaissance Squadron. The unit was responsible, he told The Intercept in 2018, for over 20% of the total of all Hellfire missiles expended in 14 years of the system's deployment. The U.S. air war in Libya accelerated in 2016 with Operation Odyssey Lightning. That summer, the Libyan Government of National Accord requested American help in dislodging Daesh from Sirte. The Obama administration designated the city an area of active hostilities, loosening guidelines designed to prevent civilian casualties. Between August and December of that year, according to an AFRICOM press release, the U.S. carried out in Sirte alone 495 precision airstrikes against vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, heavy guns, tanks, command and control centers, and fighting positions. Those military strikes were nothing new. The United States has been conducting attacks in Libya since before there even was a Libya, and almost a United States. In his first address to Congress in 1801, President Thomas Jefferson spoke of coastal kingdoms in North Africa, including the least considerable of Barbary states, Tripoli, now the capital of modern Libya. His refusal to pay additional tribute to the rulers of those kingdoms in order to stop their state-sponsored privateers from seizing American sailors and cargo kicked off the Barbary Wars. In 1804, Lieutenant Stephen Decatur led a daring nighttime mission, boarding a captured U.S. ship, killing its Tripolitan defenders and destroying it. And an attack the next year by 9 Marines and a host of Allied mercenaries on the North African city of Derna ensured that the shores of Tripoli would have prime placement in the Marine Corps hive. A June 2021 Pentagon report on civilian casualties did acknowledge one of those incidents, the death of a civilian in Al-Baida, Yemen, on January 22, 2019. Matbana's investigation determined that the attack killed Saleh Ahmed Mohammed Al-Ghaisi, a 67-year-old farmer who locals said had no terrorist affiliations. The U.S. had previously acknowledged 4 to 12 civilian deaths in a raid by Navy SEALs on January 29, 2017, also chronicled by Matwana. Through it reported a high death toll. As for the remaining allegations, Central Command, which oversees U.S. military operations in the West Asia region, told Matwana in an April 2021 letter that it was confident that each airstrike hit its intended Al-Qaeda targets and nothing else. Rigorous investigative reporting by the New York Times on the last U.S. drone strike of the Afghan war in August 2021 forced an admission from the Pentagon. What General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had originally deemed a righteous strike had actually killed 10 civilians, seven of them children. A subsequent Times investigation revealed that the 2019 U.S. airstrike in Baghouz, Syria, had killed up to 64 non-combatants, a toll previously obscured through a multi-layered cover-up. The Times followed that up with an investigation of 1,300 reports of civilian casualties in Iraq and Syria, demonstrating, wrote reporter Azmat Khan, that the American air war in those countries was marked by deeply flawed intelligence, rushed and often imprecise targeting, and the deaths of thousands of civilians, many of them children, a sharp contrast to the American government's image of war waged by all-seeing drones and precision bombs. Since the Sirte campaign ended in late 2016, U.S. attacks in Libya have slowed considerably. AFRICOM conducted 7 declared airstrikes there in 2017, 6 in 2018, 4 in 2019, and none since. But the U.S. military has made little effort to re-evaluate past strikes and the civilian casualties they caused, including the November 2018 attack that killed Nasser Musa Abdullah. U.S. Africa Command followed the civilian casualty assessment process in place at a time and determined that the reports were unsubstantiated, said AFRICOM spokesperson Kelly Callan. Despite the criminal complaint filed on April 1st, the command is not re-examining the case. There is nothing new or different regarding the November 30, 2018 airstrike, Callan told reporters by email. Africa Command has clearly moved on, but Abdullah can't. Memories of his brother and those charred bodies are irrevocably lodged in his mind, but get caught in his throat. He says, I was in shock. He told reporters when discussing the phone call that preceded his dash across the desert. I'm so sorry, but I can't explain in words what I felt. Abdullah was similarly stuck when he attempted to describe the grisly scene that greeted him hours later. He was eloquent in speaking about the justice he seeks and how being branded a terrorist robbed his brother and their community of dignity. But of his final memory of Nasser, there is simply nothing that can be said. Not by him anyway. What I was seeing was so terrible. He told reporters, his voice rising, racked and loaded with pain, adding, I can't even describe it.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina wa Mawlana Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. Salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. وعلى أهل بيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Brothers and sisters, we learned to address Imam Ridha alayhi salam as the kind Imam, or the Imam who's Ra'uf from his son, Imam al-Jawad. This is what he says. The Imam addressing his father. As-salamu ala al-imam al-ra'uf. Peace be on the Imam who is merciful and kind. If you don't mind, brothers and sisters, let me explain what merciful and kind means. Because every Imam is Rahim, but he has been called Ra'uf. Every Imam is Ra'uf. But why him? Why this name? Why this title? You see, actually, that is one of the titles or the names or the attributes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah calls himself Rahim, and then right after that, he also calls himself Ra'uf. What's the difference between these two if they're both merciful? What they tell us is that it's a special kind of mercy, a deeper kind of mercy, a type of mercy where you can't bear for the person who's coming to you to experience any difficulty. The example that our scholars give us is that you might go to a doctor, let's say there's a small child, and this child, in order to get better, they need to take a shot. They might be afraid of taking shots. They might not want to take a shot, but in order to get better, I've got to give this person the shot. A merciful doctor, a doctor who's Rahim, will administer the shot. I'm doing it to help you get better. Ra'uf, they tell us, is something a little bit different. If someone's Ra'uf, like Imam al-Ridha, he doesn't want you to have to experience even the least amount of difficulty. A doctor who's Ra'uf, who knows this little child, for whatever reason, they're very afraid of the idea of getting a shot. He'll find any way, every way, some other type of medicine, something so that I don't have to give this person a shot. Even though it's so slight, even though it's good for the person, but I don't want them to experience any difficulty. When the Urafa, I'm going to mention now Allama Tabatabai, when he would try and explain to us the difference or the, because people asked him, well, every Imam is Ra'uf. Why say he's Ra'uf? Why that title for this Imam? He says it's because the mercy of the Imam, when we say he's that kind, it's tangible. Brothers and sisters, if you haven't gone, inshallah, you'll go. And you can feel for yourself, you can sense for yourself how quickly the Imam responds. In the end, if Allah gives tawfiq, I'd like to share a story from when I first went, from a person who had actually gotten a cure from the Imam, but inshallah, that'll be towards the end. But just for us to inshallah gather or get to know who it is that we're celebrating. Even they tell us, because you and I, we can experience this kindness, this ra'afa of the Imam. Once, there was a sheikh, Sheikh Muhammad Jawad Bid Abadi, one of our Urafa. He lived in the past. Ayatollah Dasghaib, Shahid Dasghaib tells this story. He says that this man was living, so this story took place 70, 80 years ago. This man decided to travel from Isfahan to Mashhad at that time. That's a 700-mile trip, brothers and sisters. If we're talking 70, 80, 90 years before, then how difficult was it to make a 700-mile trip? Using horses, how to get over. Now, he made the niyyah. He said he was going to go. And then in order to make it worthwhile, if I have to travel 700 miles to get there, he made the niyyah that he was going to stay there for 40 days. For 40 days, he would be in the company of the Imam, enjoy the Imam's presence, and then after that, he would go back to Isfahan. He would travel all that distance. He wanted to be nice, and he took his sister with him. Took his sister with him on this trip. Maybe his sister was the one who was asking him, look, you're going to go. I know it's a difficult trip. It's a long trip, 700 miles, but if you don't mind, please take me. And he said, of course, why not? They went together. Now that he was in the company of Imam Ridha, only 18 days had passed when he had a true dream. In his dream, he sees Imam Ridha. And the Imam says, I want you to go back. So he kind of protests that, Mawlaya Sayyidi, I just got here, 40 days inshallah, I traveled all that way. The Imam said, no, I want you to go back. Why?
He said, your sister, she complained to me. She misses her mother. You know how much I care for my Zawar. The ra'fa of the imam is dead. Even someone who's in his company. The sheikh woke up from his dream. He asked his sister, he said, what did you ask Imam Ridha for yesterday? She said, I really started to miss our mother. And I asked him if he would arrange for me to go back. So that's how this imam is, this caring imam. Inshallah, we get a chance to visit him. Brothers and sisters, the rewards of visiting this imam are incredible. I'm just going to mention a few of the ahadith. Inshallah, all of you, you at least make the niyyah of going. Get the reward. This is from Imam Kadhim alayhi salam. He says this, manzarahu, whoever visits him, aw bata indahu layla, or maybe Allah will give you the tawfiq, you'll stay one night in Mashhad, kamanzara Allah ta'ala, is like the person who has done ziyarah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala fi arshih. It's like visiting Allah, doing the ziyarah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on his throne. The rewards, the spiritual rewards, even if you and I, we are imperfect believers, believers who need help, who need assistance. Remember we had that story before about the promise of Imam Sadiq, and the promise that he gave even to the person who wasn't Shia. This is another one of those promises of Imam Sadiq. He says that my grandson will be buried in a place called Khurasan, in a town called Tus, Mashhad. He says that whoever visits him, manzarahu, whoever visits him and knows the right of that imam, the imam promises, akhadhtuhu biyadi yawm al-qiyamah wa adkhaltuhu al-jannah. I, Imam Sadiq, will take that person by their hand and I will make them enter paradise. The Imam says, وَإِن كَانَ مِنْ أَهْلِ الْكَبَائِرِ. Maybe this believer is a believer who struggled, was a believer who committed major sins. Imam Sadiq says, if you visit him, I will take your hand and I will personally make you enter into paradise. We ask Allah by the right of Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad that He allows us to be some of the true Shia of Imam Ridha.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Republican Senate candidate Blake Masters, who was endorsed last week by former President Donald Trump in Arizona's GOP primary, has admitted that the country is facing a problem with gun violence, but blamed the issue on black people. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Catherine Fong. The article has been published by Newsweek magazine and is titled Trump-backed Senate candidate blames gun violence on black people. In the United States, Republican Senate candidate Blake Masters, who was endorsed last week by former President Donald Trump in Arizona's GOP primary, has admitted that the country is facing a problem with gun violence, but blamed the issue on black people, frankly. "We do have a gun violence problem in this country, and it's gang violence," Blake Masters said on an 11th of April episode of The Jeff Horowitz Show, a local Arizona radio show. "It's gangs, it's people in Chicago, in St. Louis, shooting each other. Very often, you know, black people, frankly. And the Democrats don't want to do anything about that." Former President Donald Trump endorsed Blake Masters last Thursday in what was seen as a retaliatory move against State Attorney General Mark Brnovich, who refused to help the former president overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Arizona is a state where the 2020 election was rigged and stolen, and a very thorough audit proved it, Donald Trump said in a statement. "Blake knows that the crime of the century took place. He will expose it and also never let it happen again. It is my great honor to give Blake Masters my complete and total endorsement," Donald Trump said. Arizona's GOP primary won't be held until 2nd of August. The leading GOP contenders are Arizona State Attorney General Mark Brnovich, businessman Jim Lamon, and venture capitalist Blake Masters. Former President Donald Trump officially threw his weight behind Masters on Thursday, endorsing his candidacy in the Republican primary. But recent opinion polls show that Blake Masters is in third place among the GOP hopefuls. Meanwhile, Arizona's Democratic Senator Mark Kelly aims to win re-election this November as Republicans see his previously comfortably red seat as a key race to win in their bid to regain control of Congress's upper chamber. Mark Kelly managed to flip a longtime GOP-held seat blue for Democrats in a special election in 2020. The seat was previously held by Martha McSally, a Republican who was appointed to serve Arizona in the Senate until the special election for the remainder of deceased GOP Senator John McCain's term. Blake Masters, a venture capitalist and president of the Thiel Foundation, is among a number of Republican Senate candidates who have recently pushed the Great Replacement conspiracy theory, a far-right conspiracy theory suggesting that immigrants are being brought into the United States to replace white voters for a political agenda. The theory has inspired a number of mass shootings across the United States. Blake Masters has previously accused the Democratic Party of trying to change the demographics of our country, saying that they hope to import an entirely new electorate. On the Jeff Horowitz Show, Blake Masters called the Democrats light on crime and likened their approach to crime to crocodile tears. "What they mean by gun control is disarming you and me. I'm sure occasionally a ghost gun, a homemade firearm, is used in a crime, but it's pretty rare. Usually it's just a black market handgun," the Senate hopeful said. Masters added, "What they do when when they ban things like ghost guns, when they ban things like pistol braces, which they're trying to do, that's all about disarming law-abiding people. Every Town for Gun Safety, a gun control advocacy group, has tracked 84 ghost gun shootings since 2018. In Arizona, Phoenix police recovered 30 ghost guns in 2020 and collected 31 ghost guns in the first 6 months of 2021. Untraceable, DIY ghost guns are the fastest growing gun safety problem in the country. The non-profit Every Town for Gun Safety organization website says they have become a weapon of choice for violent criminals, including white supremacists. And because they can be obtained with no background checks and no questions asked, they are undermining gun safety laws across the country.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyrdom has a long history among Muslim clerics. This is the speech of the leader of the Islamic Ummah on January 13, 2020, by Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with the officials of the Martyrs Who Were Clerics Commemoration Congress. A scholar of religion, a religious authority, and a top teacher in the Islamic seminaries, namely our magnanimous Imam, entered the field of jihad and carried out that great endeavor, which was unmatched throughout the history of Shiism, considering the results that were achieved. He was a scholar, a researcher, a jurisprudent, a scholar in the principles of religion, a sage, and a mystic. In other words, he was an outstanding person in terms of religious knowledge, was the top religious authority of his time, and the best one in comparison with many other periods in history. And he achieved the highest rank in this regard. Therefore, we should not have this image in our mind that if we want to be a scholar, a religious authority, a researcher, and a prominent teacher in Islamic seminaries, this requires that we withdraw from doing jihad and the area of jihad. This is not the case. Entering the area of jihad is our duty. We must do jihad.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There are different kinds of jihad. Sometimes it may happen that jihad in science takes precedence. There are many cases in which jihad in science takes precedence. Sometimes military jihad takes precedence. Sometimes jihad in politics takes precedence. And there are times when jihad in society takes precedence. In all these cases, our young Muslim clerics and scholars must feel a sense of responsibility and know that they are the first people to be addressed by these statements, because the first and foremost responsibility of Muslim clerics is to invite people to do good. This is what the prophets did. This is our first responsibility, and the best means for inviting to do good is through action. Action in the area of inviting to do good. Therefore, entrance into the area of jihad is a clear, definite responsibility for religious scholars and Muslim clerics.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.